I'm Ian Donis, political reporter for the Publix Radio. Welcome to a special extended version of Political Roundtable. The Rhode Island House Speaker is often called the most powerful politician in the state. That's because the Speaker controls the flow of legislation, state house jobs, and the direction of the state budget. The current Speaker, Warwick Democrat Joe Shikarchi, was elected to that post by his membership in the House of Representatives last January. Shikarchi has been on an extended political honeymoon since then, thanks in part to his easygoing personality. But Rhode Island still faces big challenges, including underperforming schools and a less than stellar business climate. Shikarchi's private law office was struck by a fire of unidentified origin earlier this year. And then there's the ongoing progressive challenge to the establishment Democrats who make up the legislative mainstream. We'll talk with one of those progressive Democrats later in the show. But first, my conversation with House Speaker Joe Shikarchi. Welcome back to the Publix Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me again.
Are lawmakers going to return for a special session later this year?
It's possible. I don't know if it's probable, but it's possible. It really depends if we can come to some kind of resolution or consensus on a couple of major bills. If we can, we certainly would come back. But if we can't and we continue to fall to work on them, we're going to work on them right until January.
Beyond recreational marijuana, what are the other top issues that would be considered during a special session?
The law enforcement, policeman's law enforcement's Bill of Rights, it's called LIBOR. Those are the two main issues that we came very close to LIBOR, but we could not get it over the finish line. So that's pretty much a priority, as well as marijuana legalization, recreational use of it.
If this special session happens, will it take place at the State House?
Yes, of course. At the moment, right now, as if it's taping, yes, of course. Now, if something happens regarding COVID, we get ourselves into a second emergency situation, we'll make that evaluation. We're always going to do what's in the best health and safety of the membership and the public.
On recreational marijuana, there are competing proposals from Governor Dan McKee and the state Senate. Does this mean that the preference of the House of Representatives will rule the day in ironing out these different proposals?
No, I don't like to say the House will rule the day. I mean, some people like to say that. I like to say we'll work toward consensus. What I will tell you is, in addition to the Senate proposal and the governor's proposal, there are several other advocacy groups, and they have different proposals as well. Unfairly so, sometimes I or the House gets blamed for stopping the the legalization of recreational use of marijuana, when in reality, there is no consensus. There are six or seven different competing proposals, and how do you approve which one of them you approve and why and how? All these things need a full public hearing and vetting, and I try to work with consensus. That's the, the hallmark of the House, at least this past session. I'd like to continue that way. So if we can come to some closeness in the several different proposals, then we'll move some kind of legislation. But if not, it just needs more work. And it's very workable. So it's very much something that can happen. We just have to put the effort in and make it happen.
A lot of political insiders were part of the past application process when it came to medical marijuana. Now, with the state possibly looking at legalizing recreational marijuana, is this shaping up as a gold rush for connected individuals?
I don't see it that way. I don't really know, what bill will pass. I don't know who, when you talk about the connected people, who they are and what they're asking for. They go through a process. We don't, in the General Assembly, pick the winners or losers. DBR does that, and they're doing it now by lottery. So I think the process is very fair as it currently exists, and I'm going to make sure that, at least from the House perspective, it remains that way. And we will not be selecting who gets licenses and where they get them. That'll be done by the executive branch of government.
The General Assembly and you will be presiding over the redrawing of legislative lines for the legislature this year. This happens every 10 years following the reapportionment and the U.S. Census. Who will the winners and losers of that process be in the Rhode Island House of Representatives? Will any members lose their districts?
I would have no idea how that would work. I don't know. I've never seen any of the data, so I don't know that. The data won't come out until sometime late next month in August. It'll be a very public and fair and open process, and we'll follow the numbers. They're not going to be any kind of picking and choosing regarding members, who's in and who's out kind of thing. Whatever the numbers tell us, what population has shifted in Rhode Island, and the census will show that, and the districts have to reflect that.
Well, I'm sure your chief of staff, Ray Simone, is in close contact with the state's redistricting consultant, Kimball Brace. That's traditionally the case. Is that indeed happening?
No, not at all. Well, I think we've met with Mr. Brace once. Everything has been delayed this year because of COVID. The amount of information that they have supposed to give us and when they're supposed to give us has been delayed. So we're going to have a lot to do in a very short amount of time. But no, I've only spoke to Kim Brace myself once. I think Ray Simone's only speaking to him maybe once or twice. But we're letting the process play itself out in the normal course, and we're going to follow whatever the data tells us to do.
Who will lead the redistricting process for the House of Representatives? Which of your members?
We have not decided that. I sent out an email to all my members. I have four legislative picks. I'm obviously going to pick two men and two women. I will tell you that there are over 22 people, 22 current members of the General Assembly want to serve on that committee. So I have to make a decision on that.
Isn't it a conflict of interest for legislators to be handling the process and deciding the process for the redrawing of their own legislative lines? This is traditionally used to reward friends and punish enemies of the leadership. So isn't that a conflict of interest?
I don't see it that way at all. It's been that way traditionally. Mr. Brace has been hired prior to me becoming the speaker. He's been doing this for the last 30 years without any challenges from the court system. The system has worked the last 30 years. Since we've already paid at least half his salary before it became speaker, I see no reason to change it. This is how other states have done it. Rhode Island has done it since I can remember, and I see no reason to change it. And there's been no outcry when we've gone through the process this year to pick the committee and to enable the law and basically rewrite the law of the last 10 years in terms of how we picked the redistricting committee. There was very little opposition to it. Some people came forward with different ideas of how it should be done, but we've done this way traditionally, and half of it was already paid for. I wasn't about to waste taxpayers' money.
Speaker Shikarchi, you have over $1 million in your campaign account, so you might be safe from a primary challenge. But progressives do hope to increase their ranks once again in the Rhode Island House and Rhode Island Senate next year. I am hearing that they plan to challenge your majority leader, Chris Blazejewski of Providence. How do you plan to defend Blazejewski and your other members against the progressive challenge?
I don't think anybody needs defending. People will run their record. Chris is an extremely talented, bright, and hardworking legislator. He is very much in tune and connected to his district, as I am, as I think most of my leadership team is. Everyone has a right to run. We don't own these seats. And you say it's my seat or this one's seat. These seats belong to the public, and public have a right to make choices. And I think a democracy, this happens, and it's healthy for a democracy. Chris will be fine. He'll do a good job. We'll all work hard, and we'll run on our record. This has been an extremely productive year. It's been a good year for the General Assembly. I have seen some public opinion polls where the General Assembly has never been higher that I can remember in the last 30 or 40 years in terms of popularity with the public. So I don't want to say I welcome that, but it's part of the process that we get elected. We put ourselves out before the voters. People have a choice if they want to run against us, whether it's myself or Leader Blazejewski or any other member of the General Assembly, and we will work hard to take our record of achievements. And there were a lot of successes to the voters, and the voters make the decisions.
One priority for the progressive movement in Rhode Island is so-called Medicare for All. Do you support that? If not, why not?
It's not that I don't support it. I just no one tells me how they're going to pay for it. It's a very expensive program, and we need to know where that money's coming from. And we only have so many dollars in a state budget. So if we're going to fund that program, where's that money coming from? And what programs are we cutting, or which taxes are we raising? So we have to balance that, and we have to look at that, what's best for everybody, not just a certain segment that wants something. I understand there are a lot of people who want a lot of things. It's one thing in the past session I've learned: the business community wants something, the average Rhode Islander wants something, the public unions want something, the private union wants something, at different advocacy groups on all sides of the spectrum, from the most conservative to most progressives, all want something. We try to listen to everybody. We try to give everybody fair consideration, and we try to move the bills that matter, that we can and we can afford, and that the majority of the House of Representatives support.
Speaking of dollars, Rhode Island is getting about $1.1 billion with a B in the latest federal stimulus. What are your priorities for the spending of that money? What is the best bang for the buck?
I continue to think, first of all, there's going to be an open and public process. So it's not going to be a checkbook for Joe Shikachi to spend any way he wants. It doesn't work that way. But my personal priorities, and which are most of the House members' priorities, will still continue to look at affordable housing and what we can do. It's a significant problem. It's a great need. We've done a lot of things this year that, six months ago were not unheard of. We created a revenue stream. We have a housing czar. We're looking at all different ways. There's $200 million in rental assistance available to Rhode Islanders, landlords, tenants, pay utility bills, pay rent, pay mortgages, pay taxes. We're going to continue to make sure that we have a permanent revenue stream that will go toward funding affordable housing. We're going to create a housing czar, someone who can coordinate all of the great work that a lot of nonprofits do and the state does, give us a plan to move forward and be held accountable to the General Assembly and the public. What are the goals? What are realistic? What we can meet, what we can't meet, why and how come, and how we can improve on that.
This stimulus money has to be spent by sometime in 2024. Would it make sense to spend it sooner rather than later when the economic harm from the pandemic is greatest?
I think that it doesn't really matter when you spend it. It's how you spend it. And I think you have to spend it smart. So I'm not in a rush to spend it. I think we should look at ways that can be used, make good long-term benefits to the state. I have always said publicly, and I'll continue to say, this money should not be spent. This money should be invested.
Rodan has a gubernatorial election next year. Are you supporting Governor Dan McKee for re-election?
Not at the present time. I have a great working relationship with the governor, but I'm uncommitted. I think it's too early, and we only have one announced candidate so far. Let's see who else is announcing. And there are other people who have approached me about running who are not public. So it's not just the four major players you see. There are other people looking at the governorship, and there are other people looking at other offices. So I think it's too early. Concentrating on doing the people's business right now. The politics will come after.
Providence Mayor Jorge Elorza this week unveiled a working group to look at the capital city's structural challenges, including the $1.2 billion unfunded pension liability. A lot of the messaging sounded like the city is looking for state assistance to resolve this pension crisis. Do you think the state should be part of that and the taxpayers of the state?
I don't think the state should be part of the financial solution, but I think the state should be part of the solution. They're going to need state approval if they want to move forward with this pension obligation bond. They're going to require General Assembly approval from the House and Senate and support from the governor as well. So we need to look at this. It's a serious problem in the city of Providence. We need to monitor it. We need to offer assistance when we can. I'm not so sure that the state has the capability financially or morally to fund the Providence pension system.
How long do you hope to remain Speaker after having first won that office in January of this year?
I take it one term at a time. I never set a limit. I never choose. I let every opportunity that presents itself be considered. I'm in no hurry to leave. I enjoy the job. I like it very much. I've only been in the job for 8 months. Not even 8 months. It's 7 months, actually. It'll be 8 months done this weekend. But the reality is it's been a challenging year for me, both personally in many ways. I've had some health issues with family members that are significant. I had a devastating fire that hurt my private practice. But in the end, the people's business was a priority. It got done. It got done very well. And I'm proud of the accomplishments of all my colleagues in the General Assembly.
In terms of the fire at your Warwick law office, which was shared by a number of other lawyers, do you have any new information about what happened? So far, authorities were not able to pinpoint a cause. What is your understanding of what happened?
The latest information I have, it is still being actively investigated, and I'm just not going to speculate. I'm going to let the professionals do their job, and the people I've been in contact with are doing a very good job, and I'm satisfied with their work, and I'm just going to let the process play itself out.
Do you view the speakership as a terminal office in that you, whenever your term as speaker comes to an end, that you would not run for another political office after that?
No, I don't. I think that if you do a good job and you have a desire and a want and you can present yourself to the voters for another office, and they will make the decision. It has been in the past, and I understand why you would ask that question. A lot of people feel like the speaker is the last job you have as an elected official. That may be true. It may not. Maybe someday I'll find out. Maybe someday I won't. And maybe we'll leave it for another speaker and another generation to make that decision. But right now, I'm very content, very happy being the speaker. I have a great leadership team. I have a great staff, and I'm very happy being the speaker of the House of Representatives, and I hope to stay for a long time.
Finally, you are known for your affection for your dog, Merlin, and you are involved in some kind of benefit for dogs coming up. Tell us about that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're having a charity benefit this coming Monday. I will tell you, unfortunately, it's sold out for your listeners. It's at the Quineset Country Club. We're going to be supporting 100% of the proceeds are going to two animal charities, the Warwick Animal Shelter and the Rhode Island Stars Animal Shelter. And they're both great organizations. They do what I call God's work, and they help find homes for abandoned pets. They're a great organization. I'm proud to support them.
Rhode Island House Speaker Joe Shikarchi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
We wanted to get another perspective on how state house politics affect Rhode Islanders. Joining me now is one of the progressive organizers who is challenging the status quo of politics in the state. Enrique Sanchez is the political director for Black Lives Matter Rhode Island, and he's allied with progressive groups like Sunrise Providence and the Brown University chapter of Democratic Socialists. Enrique works as an educator in the Providence Public Schools. Enrique Sanchez, how did you get interested in politics?
At a very young age, growing up, watching a lot of films, history, government, a lot of military films, a lot of world, international, foreign affairs, politics. You know, it's been a ride growing up. And as I got older, I just started getting into electoral politics, foreign policy, international politics, elections, etc.
For a long time, the General Assembly has been typified by this kind of hybrid Democrat, socially conservative Democrats. Why is it that we've seen a lot more challenges by progressive Democrats in recent election cycles?
I would say because of the amount of people that are moving here from other parts of the country. You see a lot of the new progressive ideology coming into place with a lot of the internal conflicts, political conflicts across our state and across the country, disagreements, the polarizing, right? The election of Trump was a very polarizing event that shook up many perspectives and points across people's minds, right? So there, and here in Rhode Island, I would say there is a lot of that young energy ready just to come out.
Beyond Trump, beyond people moving here, there have obviously been huge changes in technology with the internet. Has that been a big factor in progressive challenges?
I would say technology is a important factor that has helped progressives, fueled a lot of energy through Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, different podcasts that has caught the attention of many young people, but has also hurt progressives in many ways. I would say it has helped more progressives than it has hurt them.
One of the raps from some progressive candidates that we heard last year was that, in their view, the General Assembly or the leadership of the General Assembly doesn't do enough to address the concerns of everyday working Rhode Islanders. At the same time, we know that the state has a pretty generous social safety net. Even if legislative leadership had to be pushed by public pressure, they did support the legalization of same-sex marriage in 2013, supported the legalization of a state-based abortion law in 2019. The minimum wage has gone up. So is that criticism that the leadership is too remote from the concerns of everyday Rhode Islanders overstated?
Well, I think it's very important to take into consideration the fact that a lot of our leadership, right, they're folks who live outside of Providence, right? But even then, there are a lot of working class Rhode Islanders in places like Cranston, Warwick, East Greenwich, North Kingston, East Providence, et cetera, who I think a lot of folks would want Medicare for All, right? We look at our political leadership, you know, they're folks from Warwick, from Smithfield, from Cumberland, from Little Compton. And there are a lot of folks in those communities who would want to push for progressive policies like Medicare for All, for a $15 minimum wage. And so I feel like there's this disconnect, right, where every progressive policy is confused for some like very radical policy, right? And that's not the case. And in the instance of the $15 minimum wage and the same-sex marriage that passed in 2013, I would say that those are initiatives, policies that had to pass because people were fed up, right? They, you know, the conservative social ideology is, you know, give people crumbs, right? And they'll be happy with that. And that's not working out, in my opinion, at least, and people want more than that.
How would you describe the top progressive goals as far as legislative races next year in 2022?
Mm-hmm. To win as many seats as we can in the Senate and the House, to win at the leadership positions, to push for more Medicare for All and make that, you know, pass through the Senate and the House. The governorship's race, you know, is very important as well. But I feel like the General Assembly is the rocking point, you know, for a lot of the progressive legislation that we want to see passed. There's momentum building up and folks are excited for next year.
Do you expect we will see a Democratic challenge next year to, say, someone like House Majority Leader Chris Blazejewski of Providence?
Yes, there will be, most likely, I think.
And tell me a little bit more about that. Blazejewski, you know, he used to organize a group called Drinking Liberally. He mm-hmm. came up as a liberal or progressive. Mm-hmm. Usually when people move into leadership, they go a little bit more toward the center. But, mm-hmm. you know, what are the issues that he is not supporting that, in your view, justifies mm-hmm. a Democratic challenge to him?
He was apparently a supporter of the Green New Deal. And, you know, he didn't support Rhode Island, New England coalition policies that folks were trying to get him to push to sign on to. He didn't support Medicare for All when it came down to, you know, presenting it within his chamber. You know, it has been a disappointment, you know, to see him flip-flop from what, you know, he was campaigning on back then.
What would you point to as the best progressive success in recent years and the biggest frustration or mistake?
The biggest progressive accomplishment would definitely have to be last year, this past election cycle, right? We saw a good amount of folks who identify as progressive get elected, you know, State Rep Morales, Senator Tara Mack, Senator Cynthia Mendez, Senator Kendra Anderson, and other folks, several folks who want seats. When we also saw some, you know, changes within the city, Providence City Council as well, but we still have work to do there. And disappointments has been there is a little division amongst the progressive left as well here in Rhode Island that we're trying to clean up and we're trying to improve that.
Enrique Sanchez, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it.
Our final guest is our own Ana Gonzalez, host of the Immigration Podcast on the Public's Radio Mosaic. Ana Gonzalez, I just spoke with Enrique Sanchez about politics, and you're talking with him and Jess Brown as part of Fringe Fest. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this Friday and Saturday, July 30th and 31st, as part of Fringe PVD 2021, the Wilbury Theater Group has been kind enough to work with us to create a community stage. And what we're doing is kind of like a live taping of Mosaic, but also a community event where we're going to have two nights of music and then a main conversation, the first night with Enrique and the second night with Jess Brown, a.k.a. Lady J, then open it up to the community. So we're going to have essays, we have some poems planned, and then if anybody wants to, like, reflect on the theme of both nights, which is how has COVID affected you in your personal life, but also the work that you do. And so that's why we're talking with Enrique and Jess, because Enrique is very much an educator and an activist and an organizer, and Jess is an artist and also a professor at RISD. So both of their work and personal lives and kind of creative lives have been heavily affected by the pandemic, and they both have thought a lot about it. And then Saturday night, there's going to be a salsa band after. So it should be a mix of, like, reflecting, healing, talking through some hard stuff, but then having a good time.
Something for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
As the host of Mosaic, the immigration podcast on the Public's Radio, I am dazzled by the depth and breadth of stories that you've told, success stories, stories of discrimination. What was the genesis of this podcast?
The conception of Mosaic started before I came to the station. I think there was an idea to make a podcast about what is the current state of immigration in Rhode Island. What's going on in the lives of people who have immigrated right now, and not from a historical perspective, not from kind of a paternalistic perspective of writing about people for other people. I was brought on along with Alex Nunes in 2019 to create a long form podcast from the perspective of immigrants.
And Alex is now our South County reporter.
Exactly. Yeah, still holding it down in South County. What we did was we developed more of like a narrative style documentary podcast because that felt like the truest way to represent a lot of the intense traumas that happen in immigration. The fact that immigration itself is a traumatic event in so many people's lives. And to capture exactly what you're saying, like the breadth and the depth and the complexity of a lot of these stories. And it's grown over the past 2.5 years. We've put out 2 seasons of that narrative documentary style. And now we're in a more conversational style, a podcast that we've been experimenting with over the summer.
Where can people find this if they want to check out some of the archival episodes?
Sure. Every episode is available on our website, which is mosaicpodcast.org. You could also go to thepublicsradio.org and click on the big mosaic button on the right-hand side. And there you'll find photos, some videos, some archival papers and documents and kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. And then also our community essays, which is something that's been really exciting that we launched this summer with the help of our community producer, Pearl Marvel. So that's been really cool getting to hear from more people. They don't have to be immigrants themselves. Maybe they have an interesting story to having to do with immigration. Like this coming weekend, an essay that we're featuring is written by a former, I think he was in the Coast Guard, a member of the military who was tasked with building the border wall. So he's not an immigrant, but he has a lot of thoughts about building the wall, what immigration means to this country. And so this community essays section is a cool place to get people, to get new voices on the air.
Immigration is a quintessentially American story. What are some of your key takeaways that you have from having done this series for a few years?
Well, immigration is a huge subject. And so when people talk about immigration, they either tend to romanticize it and make it about like their family's history or make it about pressing breaking news, the border wall, hot button topics, and really dehumanize the subject. But at the end of the day, immigration is really the intersection of something that is deeply personal, the choice to move to another country, or it's oftentimes not a choice. They have to move, and they, in the case of refugees, are placed here. They don't get to choose where they go. So it's the intersection of that and law and the current state of politics. And so it creates this really complicated world that people have to navigate. And sometimes people are successful and sometimes they're not. Anybody who hasn't lived through the process, I don't think understands the depth and the nuances of it. I don't fully understand it. And every single person I've talked to has a completely different story from the next. And so every time I talk to somebody or make an episode, I learn something completely new that blows my mind.
To follow up on what you're saying, immigration generates a lot of political heat. Democrats and Republicans haven't been able to get together since the 1980s on major immigration legislation. Even in Rhode Island, former Governor Gina Raimondo highlighted support for driver's licenses for undocumented when she was running for governor in 2014, and that has not gotten done. She said the legislature had to do it. What do you make of this kind of paralysis on these issues around immigration?
I think it's baked into our very Constitution that immigration is not something that anybody ever agreed on. There are words like alien. There's something about the moral, the characters, the good character clause in the Constitution that is from like the 1790s, saying that if you have good moral character, you can be an immigrant. But the good moral character meant being a white man, landowning, and that you never like murdered somebody. From that point on, the list has gotten longer and longer and more complicated of what it means to be a good immigrant. And I think that's something that like the American dream is based off of, too. The law is so complicated. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know one person who could know the answer. I hope that legislators talk to more people who've experienced the system and meet them where they're at in terms of language, citizenship, the amount of money it costs to become a citizen, or to even get permanent legal resident status, and refugees as well. I think that's a whole nother side of this that people don't talk about enough.
Ana Gonzalez, thanks so much for sitting down to talk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Thanks for listening. If you have a question or comment, drop us an email at news@ripr.org or connect with me on Twitter at Ian Don. This has been a production of the Publix Radio. CEO and General Manager Tori Malatia, Chief Content Officer and Managing Editor Sally Isley, and Production Director James Baumgartner. I'm Ian Donis, and I'll see you on the radio.